This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. Speaker is Vin Lewis, founder and head of All Roads Ministry. This tape is entitled, An Approach to Death. It deals with that most basic fact of life, to use the word somewhat ironically, death. And it is some comments on what I believe is the proper Christian approach to death, the thing which we must all face at one time or another. There are, I believe, essentially two extreme approaches to death. That is to say, two poles by which we may measure our attitude. The first is one contained in a statement which I have heard attributed to Jesus, although it is nowhere written in Scripture. But even though it is not, and therefore is apocryphal, I believe it is a proper Christian approach to death. Life is a bridge. You must cross it, but you should not build your house upon it. When we look at Jesus, we will certainly understand, as he says in the Gospel of St. John, that the reason he came to the earth was to bear witness to the truth, and everyone committed to the truth hears his voice. But there are other references repeatedly stated that Jesus came, in essence, to die. Jesus was born, came to the earth to shed his blood, to die upon the cross, to open the gates of heaven so that man may be reconciled with God. And that is the first point of death, which I think is of significance, is that death is a means by which reconciliation may take place. The death of Jesus made reconciliation between God and man possible. Our own individual deaths are necessary in order to bring about our own individual reconciliations between God and man. Unless God brings about some miracle, as he apparently did in the case of Enoch and Elijah, the only way for us to be with God is to die. And this is an overriding concept and an overriding thought and an overriding theme that we should keep in mind when we prepare for death or think about it. I mentioned before that there are two polar positions on the approach to death. And the first one, of course, as I mentioned, was Jesus. The second is, and of course this is the polar opposite of Jesus, the remark of an AIDS activist. By AIDS, of course, I mean the acquired immune deficiency syndrome, the disease caused by the HIV virus, which infects primarily the homosexual population of America. And an AIDS activist, a rampant radical advocate of homosexuality, was on a radio show complaining in an hysterical voice that the American government does not contribute enough funding to AIDS research. And he had made this prediction that 40,000 or 400,000 or 4 million or 40 million people would die within the next 2 or 3 hours or 2 or 3 years. The numbers don't mean anything because these people, unfortunately, are affected by the dementia, both of this disease, physical, and the disease, spiritual, and therefore say things which are not rational. But I'm not concerned with his facts. I'm concerned with the presentation of his attitude. He stated this vast number of people would die. And then he asked the listening audience a rhetorical question. Where will we even bury these people? It was a perfect example of the AIDS activist, that is the homosexual, that is the person immersed with sin who has rejected God, and his attitude towards death. Because what this man was saying was the following. If AIDS is not cured, these people will die. If AIDS is cured, these people will live forever. It never occurred to him in his mind or in his speech that no matter if AIDS were to be cured tomorrow, everyone will die, and everyone, every corpse, will produce the same situation of where will we bury the bodies. Now, this is not an argument or a discussion on the future of the cemeteries, but notice the point. This man, this activist, this group of people deny the very existence of death. Death is associated with one specific evil with which they object, with which they struggle. And if that can be solved, death can be eradicated. They will not die. Complete 100% denial of reality. because the reality is that death is terrifying for them. Now, all of us, in a certain sense, fear death. All of us, in a certain sense, are repelled by it. Yet we all, in our more rational, saner, and shall we say more profound and theological moments, understand that death is the inescapable end of life. And in a certain sense, one may say that life itself is an incurable disease, because it always is fatal. One of the reasons, I believe, why death seems to be so upsetting to us, and in reality is upsetting to most of us, is because of two basic characteristics we associate with death. The first is the concept of limitations. The second is the concept of ignorance. Now, we're talking about death. We're not talking about dying. It's very obvious that most of us have aversions to certain forms of dying. Some of us don't wish to starve to death. Others of us would find being burnt to death more unpleasant than freezing to death, etc. So we're not talking about the dying process. We're talking about the end result, the transitional stage, the afterlife. We're talking about death itself. Again, in death, we obviously believe that we will be limited in what we can do after we are dead. We won't be able to see our loved ones, to touch them, to share a meal with them. We won't be able to do the things that we can do now. We won't be able to see a sunset. We won't be able to smell a flower. We won't be able to watch a ball game. At least that's our impression of what death is. The second is the concept of ignorance. Ignorance both in two senses. Number one, we don't know in the same sense that we know other things by personal experience or universal consent of mankind what is happening after we die. We don't know what's on the other side. The second thing is we feel as if we're going to not know what's happening after we're gone. We won't know what happens to our family. We won't know what happens to our children, our grandchildren, the job we left, or even the sports teams we follow and whose fortunes we advocate. I cannot fully dispel these doubts, these problems, these inhibitions to dying, so to speak, but I might be able to use, if possible, an analogy which should give you some glimmer of faith and hope. When you were in your old grammar school, you felt as if that was, in many ways, the world. You felt as if the grammar school was very important and you were very important to it. And things that happened there were very important to you. If that grammar school still exists today, and if you're a normal person, you have little or no interest in it, a vague sentimental attachment to it. If you see its name in the paper, you might be interested. But you don't really care who gets the highest mark in the math test these days and who flunks the spelling test. You don't care which two friends are fighting, and you don't care what happens to the principal. Why? Because you have passed on to a higher stage. It is not as if you are indifferent in any negative sense, and it is not as if these things were not important to you at one time, but you have, in a true sense of the word, outgrown them. You have made a transition to a further stage, and again, if you are normal, you feel no loss, no regret, no sense of emptiness, no sense of deprivation, because these things are no longer of interest to you. It is the Catholic position on death that those things which you do not carry over with you are of no real value and no real interest to what and who you truly are. In that case, it is important to understand that this analogy of the transitional stages of life, which change the important and the essential to the trivial and the non-essential, is probably an analogy put into life by God for us to learn and for us to have faith and for us to have confidence that in death what we carry on will be important. If our family is important, we will still be in contact with them somehow. But Dad, let me go back a little bit to the approach that Jesus had to death as opposed to the AIDS activist. Let us understand that by nature, and I take it as axiomatic and I'm not going to prove it here, all things are created with a purpose, with an end. God creates everything that he creates for a reason. We all have a golden life. We all have a part in his eternal plan. Our individual goal, separated from other people, is quite literally to die. But to die correctly. As all of life leads to death, sometimes very quickly after the beginning of life, sometimes many years later, but it always leads to death, we must logically conclude, inevitably conclude, inescapably conclude, that death is in fact the end of life, end in the sense of termination, end in the sense of the word goal. Life, properly understood then, is a preparation for death. If I may use an analogy again, death is the contest for which we prepare. The Olympic skater spends years and years and years practicing so that on the individual day of the race, the one race that occurs but just every 4 years, and he may participate in only once, he has prepared years. All of his training life and much of his sacrifices in his social life and his financial life are geared to this one event, this one time, this one place. He either succeeds or he fails at that point. In a certain sense, death is a contest because our state at the time of death determines our faith in the sense of where we go and where we don't go. In general, let me give a brief summary of what occurs at death. After we die, we are judged. That is to say that God looks at the determination of our state, of our soul. If we are in the state of grace, that is to say, not in the state of mortal sin, a state of grace being in a friendly sharing with God, then we avoid hell. However, if we are not yet purified, not yet in as perfect a state of friendship with God as we could, we therefore must go to purgatory. And our time in purgatory is determined by how many sins we have on our soul, venial sins, not yet confessed, remitted, or forgiven, and how much temporal punishment we have on our souls due to sins already forgiven. At this time, rather than go into a great deal of detail, I would simply refer you to the tape dealing with purgatory, which outlines this further. One of the problems in talking about these things is that we are talking about things in terms of ordinary temporal concepts. In other words, while we are alive, we say that Monday follows Tuesday, Tuesday follows Wednesday, 1991 follows 1990 and precedes 1992. Time certainly has a different meaning when we are dead, because certainly we cannot get any older. And getting older is one of the key concepts of time. It is a key concept of change. If we die at age 70, we will not be age 70 for all eternity. Exactly what age we will be is not known. By the same token, a child who dies before he grows, at say only 2 or 3 days after birth, will not be an infant unable to speak or function in the normal ways of a human being for all eternity. He will not change, but he will be fulfilled. So will all of us. So sometimes, by the limitation of language, we get a little sloppy, and this is an unavoidable consequence. But let us take the approach of number one, that the person has achieved salvation, has believed what he was required to believe, and has done what he was required to do. And those are briefly to stay faithful to the Catholic Church. Allow me to make one comment here about the concept of faithfulness. I don't believe that any of us, absolutely, at any particular time, can reel off every single thing that Catholics believe and every single thing that the Catholic Church has taught. Most of us at one time have been exposed to it, and they are probably in some form of latent memory. What we must do, however, is make an implicit commitment to the institutional church. That is to say, what you teach, when I become aware of it, I accept. I make this commitment in advance, for eternity, and without qualifications. That is the necessary faith, which, again, has many different aspects. I deal with that in another tape. I will not go into it now. But that is the necessary faith, necessary for salvation. Also, however, what we have is the concept of acts and works. What must you do? Well, the best example is given in the Gospel of St. Matthew, chapter 25. Whatever you did for the least of my brethren, you do unto me. If we did not turn our backs on others, if we fed the hungry and clothed the naked, either ourselves or through surrogates, that is what is necessary for salvation. In other words, putting our love into fact, practice perfecting our faith by love. With that in mind, let me return again briefly to the concept of purgatory. In the issue of purgatory, we have immediately tied up with it the entire concept of indulgences. Indulgences are a remission, that is, a removal of some of the pain or the severity of the pain of purgatory due to some merits applied to the suffering person. This may be done briefly in one of two ways. The major way is the person during his lifetime has built up a store of merits. If we want to look at it this way, when we go to purgatory, we have a debt to be paid. If we have a certain amount of funding or credit in a bank account, we may apply that to our debt. The second way is to have someone else pay for it. In other words, someone else is willing to offer up their credit, their funds, so to speak, so that our debt may be reduced. Of course, there are many doctrines, many beliefs, many totally pious devotions, which indicate that the Blessed Mother and various different saints will also intercede for us, and I'm sure our relatives in heaven can intercede for us also. Exactly how that is applied is, in a sense, a mystery. It is a matter of functioning in faith and a matter of functioning in hope. At this point, I would simply point out that ARM does not deal primarily with the concept of devotions, but there are many sources available to learn about these, and the various stories and promises dealing with the 9 first Fridays and the first Saturdays and the wearing of the scapula are things that people should take quite seriously as they approach death. It's sort of an extended last rites. Last rites being the sacrament which is designed to ease you into the transition that death is. Well, one can start extending that before by becoming interested and exercise those devotions which are designed to ease or terminate the pains of purgatory as soon as possible. Now, again, what this does in the concept of indulgences and the concept of purgatory, again, there's tapes available from us on both of these issues, is create the situation where a loved one alive can still do something for a loved one dead. Death no longer is this entire termination, this entire sundering or severing of the love relationship between two people. Clearly in the story given by Jesus in the Gospel of St. Luke of the rich man and Lazarus, when Lazarus is in the abode of the just with Abraham, the rich man suffering in hell expresses concern for his brothers on earth. If in hell, if in torment, if in the place where the consequences of one's entire life of faith is being exercised and imposed on someone, if in hell love and concern can still be expressed, then there must follow that love and concern can still be expressed between the living and the dead, from the living to the dead, for we are not yet damned and can still express the virtues correctly. So again, the key concept here, which I'm trying to emphasize, is the concept of faith in the sense of believing, and hope in the sense of affirming and acting on the basic premise that once a person dies, he is not, quote, dead and buried, unquote. He is still alive to us, still part of our lives, still part of our loved ones' lives. And the point is, in this case, that one of the natural consequences of raising a proper family is that after you are dead, that proper family will work for you and pray for you so that you may have a lighter time of duration in purgatory. Now, at this point, I would simply like to point out that one could look at death as the third stage in our existence. In essence, there is a primal stage in which we are in the womb. We are certainly alive, we certainly have a body and soul, but we are not baptized, we are not capable of sin, we are not yet heirs of Jesus Christ's inheritance. The second time occurs after birth, what we normally call life in our sort of everyday language. Life occurs from the moment of birth till the moment of death. But this is only part of our existence, and a very small part of our existence. Then there is what is called the afterlife, the true beginning of our life. Once again, remember the concept of the bridge and the transition. It is simply a way to get from the womb to the tomb, and the tomb opens to us the gates of heaven, or for some of us, unfortunately, the gates of hell. Let me at this time go into the concept of a slow death, a death that occurs with us knowing it in advance. Now, I do not know statistically how many people are given this gift, and I will call it a gift. I have no idea. But let us assume that even those of us who are going to die suddenly as the result of an accident or some massive heart attack or something like that, even those of us who are going to experience this can understand the benefits of a slow death and realize them if we understand that right now we are slowly dying. Each day there are less days left to our life, and each day we come closer to death, and at one point we will be much closer to death than we are to birth. So therefore, in a sense, let us all accept the concept and accept the reality of a slow death. Now, what are the advantages of a slow death? And there are many. One is that we may remit via suffering our own pain and suffering in purgatory. In other words, we may build up our credit account for distribution later when we arrive there. Number two, we may seriously encourage other loved ones to do so. Let me deal with this at a little length for a moment. When we encourage other people to pray for us after we have died, or to tell them, listen, someday I'll be dead, pray for me, or I won't be here next year, please keep me in your prayers and have masses said for me, what we have done is, number one, affirmed the desire, the need, the sovereignty of God. What we have said to him is, God, I know I have sinned, I know I need remission. This is an act of contrition in the true sense of the word. It is an expression of the fear of the Lord, which the Bible said is the beginning of all wisdom. It is the exercise of virtues for yourself. Two, it is the importuning of other people to exercise for you their virtues. We have an expression which we use at ARM all the time. Always let other people allow you to be the object of their virtue. Never turn down charity. Not because of what benefits accrue for you, but for what benefits accrue for the other person. Yes, we must treat every other person as if they are Jesus, but we must let others treat us as if we are Jesus. If you ask others to pray for you, if you ask others to remember you when you are dead, while you are still alive, what you are doing is orientating their thoughts towards death, which is a good and holy thing, and asking them to express in charity their faith, which is a good and holy thing. It is an act of evangelism. Also, by the same token, the third great advantage of the slow death is that it will allow us to orientate our thoughts, our goals, our means, our ends, so to speak, towards the great test that we are coming to. As I pointed out before about the Olympic skater, he knows when the Olympics will take place, he knows what the nature of the race is, he knows the standards, and he knows the training program he must follow. Now it is simply a matter of an act of will and the degree of his physical ability. If his physical ability is great, then it is only a matter of act of will. He will win the medal if he chooses to do so. St. Paul uses this analogy with the race also and talks about the merited crown. If he keeps striving for the goal, he will win the crown. What is the only reason why we don't? Because we are distracted by daily life, because the devil whispers in our ears, because we follow the inclinations of our own flesh. But as Samuel Johnson once said, if you are going to hang a man in the morning, it focuses his mind very much the night before. If we keep in mind the fact that we are going to die, then it is a very, very good incentive for us to focus our mind, our hearts, our very beings, our efforts on what is going to occur after we die and the judgment. And logically, it follows inescapably that this increases our chances for salvation massively. Why? Because it does two things. Number one, it increases our faith. When we are concerned with something, we study about it. And the more we study about death, the less fearful it should become for the Catholic. Why? Because if we believe what Jesus said, if we believe what the Church teaches us, we are told that salvation is not only possible, but salvation is easier than damnation. Although it is a general consensus in the Church that the vast majority of people are damned. Why is this so? Because the vast majority of the people work very hard rejecting God's grace. All we need to do is accept God's grace, follow Him, let Him love us, and let Him do the rest. For after all, we are not saved by our works. They are a necessary part. We are saved by the acceptance of God. But as St. Paul says in some letters to the Romans, we are saved in hope. Interesting there. Why? Because without hope, which is the affirmation and desire for something which cannot be guaranteed, without hope, we do not have a commitment. Hope is, in this desire and affirmation for something, a commitment. And without a commitment, without an emotional desire, without an emotional and physical and psychological and willful commitment, desire and affirmation for a goal, the goal being, in this case, salvation, we cannot say that our love means anything. You cannot say that you love God or accept Him unless you desire to be with Him. For the nature of love is to desire to be with the loved one, the beloved. So hope becomes a significant factor, and without hope we cannot be saved. Why else should we have hope and faith? Because God wants us to be saved. This is a very sloppy word. God wants nothing. But to understand it in an English anthropomorphic sense, God has made the main arrangements for us to be saved. He has caused or allowed His Son to die on the cross, to suffer the agonies of the crucifixion, so that you may avoid hell. Another reason for hope. We are on the winning team. When the second judgment comes, our side will conquer all evil. All we have to do is take the very selfish act of desiring to be on the winning team. We're betting on a horse race where we have fixes in. We simply bet on the winner. You bet on the winner, you'll win. This is the winning team. The fear of hell, the fear of purgatory, makes us focus our attention on making sin less likely. We are less likely to sin if we are on a Titanic and is sinking, and we are more likely to pray fervently. Every one of us is on the Titanic. The fear of God's judgment does the same thing, orientate us again towards affirmation of His judgment, of His sovereignty, which is an act of faith, and fear of offending Him, which is an act of love. And again, we must remember, and this is another reason for hope, that hope can only exist in times of despair and fear. Courage can only exist in times of fear. If we fear death, this is the time, by an act of will, we express those virtues. We simply do not give in to the temptations. Expect them to be there, but do not give in to them. For it is an act of will, not your emotional state, not the state of your stomach, and not the cold sweat that you fear when you think of these things, but an act of will, a choosing, which ultimately puts you in heaven or hell. And what that means is, you may be saved if you will it. Will it, and you will be saved, because God does the rest. And that is God's plan, and that is God's desire. I hope that this tape has been of some help to you. I hope that it has been of help to you who are facing death in the immediate future or the foreseeable future, but I hope it has also been of help to you who do not realize when your death is coming and may take the approach that I have suggested, the slow death that we are all in. Think about it. And the last thing I would say is that a particular devotion to Saint Joseph, the patron of the happy death, who died in the presence of the Blessed Mother and Joseph and Jesus, his foster son, could not be denied at this time. Devote yourself to him, pray to him, the man who is closest to Jesus in the entire world, and spouse of the Blessed Mother. And I don't believe that you can be denied. Do it with a sincere heart. Additional copies of this tape can be obtained by contacting us at ARM 55 Palen, P-A-L-E-N, Road, L-38, that's L as in Lincoln, 38, Hopewell, one word, Junction, separate word. The state is New York. The zip code is 12533. And if I may add a personal note, if when you listen to this tape you have learned that I am dead, please pray for me. And if you can, have a mass said for me. Thank you, and God bless.